Okay. We are studying the life of Esther. And she is one of the great women of the Bible. We have seen that she is a woman who is both beautiful, at the same time very humble. And not only that, but a quiet woman. Again, obedient woman. She has all of these characteristics, as well as being a great woman of faith. And so we find, you remember, she was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And, of course, Mordecai, in the story, we see him getting himself in a little bit of trouble. He refused to bow down to the man who was exalted in the Persian kingdom, Haman. And because he wouldn't bow down to him, Haman decided that he would execute not only him, but, of course, all of his people. But we remember the background of that, he was a descendant of Agag, and so he is called, even in the text, the enemy of the Jews. And that probably explains why he went to such an extreme place there and decided to commit genocide against the Jews. But he then goes to, that is Mordecai, goes to Esther, and she now is the queen and basically commands her to go before the king and to intervene on behalf of the Jews. And she reminds him, you remember, that that to do that would be a violation of the law. And it would be a violation that would carry with it the penalty of death. But her attitude was, if I perish, I perish. And so, again, she was a woman of great faith. Fortunately, as we continued, we saw into chapter 5 or so that she didn't have to perish. The king held up the golden scepter, meaning that she had found favor with him. So what we discover is that Xerxes basically loved Esther. And I say that kind of conveniently. Like, we might say he loved her the best he could, the best he knew how in the environment that he was in, grew up in, lived in, and his culture. You know, it's hard to say that a man with a harem really loved his wife, but she certainly was his favorite, and he did have a strong affection for her, so that immediately when he looks up and sees her at the place where she wasn't supposed to be in the king's palace, he didn't get out of control, lose his temper like he often did, but again held up that golden scepter. And so we find that he then asked, he could tell that she had something on her mind, and he encouraged her, you know, what is it? I'll give you up to half of the kingdom. And, of course, he didn't mean that literally, but that he would bless her. She had found favor with him. And she then says, well, I want to have a banquet for you and Haman. And so she arranged that. They went to the banquet, and then he asked her again, what is it that's on your mind? And for whatever reason, she requests that they have another banquet, and that the king and Haman would be invited to that. Now, we don't know, you know, what, again, everything she does, as we studied, I think last week we covered most of that, that she was very skillful in what she was doing. Some believe that she really just sensed that it wasn't the right time to request his intervention for the Jews. Some have even said she lost her nerve a little bit at that moment when she was to do that. I don't know about any of that, but it seems to me she's just kind of playing him along and trying to get the perfect moment where she could be most assured that she would get what she wanted, and that is for him to intervene with regard to the Jews. But one way or another, she arranges for a second banquet, and he immediately agrees. And so Haman leaves, and he's full of joy. He's excited because he has just been a participant in a banquet where it was only the three of them, the queen and the king and himself. that told him he was special, that he had a special place in the heart of the king. He was somebody. And we know a lot of things about Haman. He was basically Satan personified in a lot of ways. Everything that God hated, he was. But what we find here, not only is he egotistical and such, but he really is obsessed with the honor that comes from man. He wanted the glory to come upon him and honor to be heaped upon him. And we'll continue to find he was obsessed with that. And so that explains why it is when Mordecai, even though everyone was bowing to him, that one man wouldn't do it, and he was furious about that. So now here he is leaving this first banquet, and he's on cloud nine, so to speak. Like, he's just thrilled that he'd been a part of this situation, and it would indeed be an honorable thing to be at a banquet when there was no one there, no one invited except for him with the king and queen. So he leaves, and he's full of joy, but he sees Mordecai in the king's gate once again, and he's even gotten worse. He doesn't even acknowledge him at all. And that alone just makes him furious. But he controls himself, and he goes home, and he praises himself to his wife and his friends and all of this that he has and he's done. But as long as Mordecai is in the king's gate, he'd be miserable. And that's when his wife, and she kind of goes to an extreme. He and the advisors give him extreme thing to do, and that is to build these gallows 50 cubits high, and have the king agree to execute Mordecai, and then go on to the second banquet with joy. And so he agrees. I mean, he thinks, oh, that's a great idea. And that gets us then to chapter 6, to where we left off. And as we get into chapter 6, again, there's a lot in chapter 6 that is providential in nature. And one of the things I've told you many times before, that the providence of God, that is a subject that is hard to really wrap your mind around completely. There's probably more questions than answers that we have with regard to the providence of God. But I, for one, believe in it. I think most of you believe in the providence of God. The Bible doesn't say a lot of things specifically about it. And in fact, just very little. Perhaps in Romans chapter 8, the passage that most of us are familiar with, you remember in Romans chapter 8 and at verse 28, we have a reference that is probably emphasizing the providence of God, in a sense at least. It says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." And most would believe that that is a statement about providence. All things work for good, providentially. God does work in the lives of his people. And, of course, over in our story, back, if you remember back in chapter 4, as I made reference to a few moments ago, when Mordecai was commanding Esther to go before the king, you remember how he put that at verse 14. "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish." Then he says, "And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And now those are words coming from Mordecai. So it is not the Bible per se, just making a statement, but we do know Mordecai believed in the providence of God. And of course we studied the life of Joseph, and we know from Genesis, if you turn over there, Genesis chapter 50, towards the end of the book, what Joseph said to his brothers at verse 20, Genesis 50 at verse 20, says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Talking, of course, about everything, throwing him in the pit and selling him into Egypt and all of that. God meant for it for good, to bring it about that many people should keep alive as they are today. So did Joseph believe in the providence of God? Absolutely. Absolutely. So the point of it is, and one of the great things we can get from the book of Esther is that God is sovereign and that he is on his throne and he's in charge. And he does work providentially in the life of his people. Now, it's hard sometimes to know exactly when that is, but he does. And I think it helps us. It helps me to know that. There are times I'm absolutely sure that God has worked providentially in my life. Can I prove that? No. You know, you always hear me say you have to put your finger on the passage when you're dealing with doctrinal things. And when it comes down to the providence, you can't be overly dogmatic. There are times when I really, you couldn't talk me out of the fact that it was the providence of God if your life depended on it. Certain things that have happened in my life. And yet, you know, I recognize that it is hard to really know, to be 100% sure. Some things in life do happen by chance, but there's a lot of things that aren't by chance, that God is working. And so it's very interesting, and it's hard to grasp, because when you think about the providence of God, we often emphasize that providence, it's not God working miraculously. And yet, when you think about it, he is manipulating certain things and events. And so there is something supernatural about that. We think in the Old Testament, God himself telling the Jews of how he sometimes would use weather, rain and wind, storms and famines and things of that nature to punish them. The book of Hosea says a lot about that, how he withheld rain from some of the tribes and gave it to other tribes. So some of them couldn't grow crops and some could, but that resulted in a lack of food for everyone, and he did all of that to bring them to repentance. We know in the life of Elijah, that, you know, just different things happening where God used natural things, but wouldn't we conclude he was manipulating those things in his power and strength? He has the ability to do that, to cause it not to rain. If God wanted to, could he make it rain tomorrow? Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm no weatherman. And I know how, how they say things come about and things form and then eventually it rains. And we have weather people who can determine it's going to be raining next Monday. It's going to be raining. And we make jokes about the weather people. But are they right most of the time? He says, no. Yes, they are. They are right most of the time. I know we're very critical and they're wrong sometimes, but you know, there's a lot of times I get on my computer, turn on the weather channel just to see if it's going to be, what's going on Friday. And I have the little raindrops on my computer. And guess what happens Friday? It rains. Like they are right most of the time. And that's just the way it is. But God can change it if he wants to. And he could cause it to rain whenever he wanted to. And stop it from raining whenever he wants to. And he could do it providentially. But I'm saying to you, he is manipulating things. And so does he do that in our lives? Yes. I can't explain it all. You know, we have to be careful that I've often said we don't put God in a box. Particularly as we talk about the ceasing of miracles and all of that, we should know exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about apostolic miracles that God set forth as a sign to do certain things, one of which is to glorify him. When God works providentially, he's not trying to glorify himself. It's God working secretly, really, invisibly, for trying to work out his plan, whatever that might be at the particular time for the particular people. So it's not like the miracles. We don't have to glorify, God doesn't have to be glorified by miracles today. We don't need the word of God to, or miracles rather, to confirm the word of God. We have the word of God for that. So when the Bible was complete, those kind of outward things, the healing, the healing the sick and making the blind seeing, the speaking in tongues, all of those things that you read in 1 Corinthians 12, they have all ceased. But is God still the supernatural God? And can he still manipulate weather and events in this world? You think he can? Anybody think he can't? I think he can. I think he does. Now, there are some who don't. I remember years ago dealing here. I was just kind of standing by, but a preacher, we having him for a gospel meeting, he was talking with one of the members, and the member was saying something, you know, it's been several years ago, so I don't remember the details of it, but there was something, somehow the member was talking, and by the way, as I say this, I was talking with Rich here the other day. It was something sort of along the same lines we were talking about, but this member had almost been in a car accident, and he wasn't, and he attributed it to the providence of God. But the preacher said, no way, that was just chance. And he was sure about that. And it sounded to me like the preacher didn't really believe in the providence of God, because his position was providence, the way it worked in the Bible, did have a miraculous element to it, and miracles have ceased. So there's no real such thing as God intervening in our lives today. How many of you would agree? I'm not asking for you to raise your hand or anything like that, but in your own mind, how many of you would agree with that? Because I don't. I think God does still work providentially in our lives. But again, it's kind of his secret, invisible working for whatever reason. I think the answering of prayer falls into that category a long way. How many of you, I've heard brethren get up and pray that God heals some of our sick. And I know sometimes when you pray for that, you mean God work through the doctors. But is that what you always mean? Because I don't get, I mean, I'm not in your mind, so I don't know, but I don't get the sense always that that's what you mean. I get the sense that when brethren pray that, they want God to intervene and help. And that would be providence. But you can see in all of that how hard it is. You know why? You hear very few sermons on providence, because the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about it, and it's kind of difficult. But as we get into Esther chapter 6, particularly the first 6 verses, there is providence all through it. Like, God is without question manipulating the events to work this story out. And there's no doubt about that. As we get into chapter 6, it's very interesting now. It's going to take a turn in chapter 6. You know, there's a statement that sometimes say, today is the first day of the rest of your life. You ever hear that before? What if someone said that to Haman? They'd be wrong about that, wouldn't it? Today is, if they would have said, hey, Haman, today is going to be the last day of your life, then they would have been right on. He doesn't have a clue of what's coming, but it's about to hit him. And it all begins with the king having a restless night. So it says, and notice how it reads in the ESV here, on that night, the king could not sleep. Notice that. On that night. That's providence. Not 2 nights after that. That'd have been too late. On that night. And I tell you what else this kind of indicates to us right away is you've noticed when it says on that night, that ties in what's going on in chapter 6 with what just happened in chapter 5. And so I point that out because you recall, as we have gone along in this story so far, in between chapters, there have been like sometimes a couple of years pass, sometimes 4 years passing. And now all of a sudden, it's all at the same time, same time period. The next couple of chapters will all happen within a couple of day period. Time is slowing down. And the reason for that is because we're getting to the very heart of the story. And so details matter. And so now it says, on that night, the king could not sleep. And so that's God somehow working. Some Greek translations read like this. The Lord kept sleep away from the king. That would indicate providence, wouldn't it? God has a hand in this. Or would you conclude that this was just all by chance and that the king just happened not to be able to sleep on this night? No, God has a hand in all of this. He gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. I want you to think about this. All the little things that make, all these things that are happening right here at the beginning of chapter 6 are all very important to the overall story and how it's going to work out in the Jews' favor. And so now the king can't sleep. So he orders them to bring him the book of Chronicles. Do you know how many different things the king could have done to entertain himself or to take up time at a night he couldn't sleep? Like he could have had him bring in one of the singers to sing a song to him or entertainer to entertain him. Or he could have done what he probably has done, I hate to say it, but he's probably have done many times before, and gotten one of his women from the harem. All these things. Why did he on this occasion decide he wanted a servant to read a book to him? And there's reasons for that. The Chronicles would have the history of the things that would happen in the Persian kingdom, and particularly as they related to the king, that would certainly be involved. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting that that's what he requested. And that's very significant to the story. If he didn't request that, none of this would have unfolded the way it did. Why did he request that? Providence. And then look at, just stop and think about it. Now this is a book of Chronicles, it says, and they were read before the king, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana, the same man spelled differently as before, chapter 2, in Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And now just stop and think about that. Like, this is a book that contains the history of things that have transpired in the Persian kingdom. How big do you think that book was? Like, what if it was just as big as this Bible? I can guarantee you it was a lot bigger, a lot thicker than this. And keep in mind that what we just read about in these Chronicles that he read about Mordecai, that was like 5 years ago. Like that happened like 5 years ago. So a lot of things have been recorded. A lot of things have transpired in that period of time. What are the chances that the one who was to read the book opened it up and started it and came across that? The exact thing that the king had to hear in order for this story to evolve the way it did. What would you call that? You can say it's chance if you want to. That's providence. The chances of that happening, it's like some people who believe in miracles today. I've heard them say, you know, yeah, I just, like when I was doing radio, I give you this, when I was doing radio, people would say, oh, God talks to me. And I say, yeah, we say, yeah, what does he sound like? Well, it's not in a verbal voice like that. But I opened up my Bible and it landed right here, and God said this, and that was God telling me what he wanted me to do. And well, that I'm sure that they weren't right about that. But now what about this? Here, this man opened up what had to be a huge book and read about an event that took place 5 years ago, that was the exact thing that the king had to hear in order for the story to turn out the way it did. I think you'd have to call that providence. Yeah, Autumn, go ahead. Yes. Yeah, it would put a dent into your prayer life if you don't believe in the providence of God, really. And so that's true. That is true. But we see it all through here. Look at what happens next. It says, and so the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And now you should know that this was something that was, it wasn't just in Persia, but particularly in Persia, since that's what we're dealing with, it wasn't a law, but it was a strong tradition that any royal benefactors would be greatly rewarded. Like, if you did anything that would help the kingdom, they would give you all kind of rewards for that. And, you know, not too many people are in a position to do something great like that, but whenever someone did help the king or the queen in any way, you were greatly rewarded for that. Now, let me ask you, when you think about saving the king's life, you think that'd be a big deal or not so much? Like, they would reward people heavily that did far less things than save the king's life. And so when someone saved the king's life, like, that would be a huge deal. What do you think would happen to me if I saved the life of the president tomorrow? You think life would just go on as if nothing happened, nothing would be said or anything? Or you think I might make the news? Think you might see me on the news? Yeah, probably so. And even back in those days when they didn't have the news cycles that we have, still, you did something good for the kingdom and particularly for the king. And if you did something like save his life, that would not be shrugged off. But what happened to Mordecai? It was pretty much shrugged off. Like, even the king is surprised here. What do we do for this man? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Okay, that's almost unbelievable. And we mentioned it in passing when we were back there in chapter 2. That was the very time when Haman was being exalted. So he was kind of a worthless man who probably bribed his way up to the top. But here's a man who saved the life of the king. And we don't read anything happening at all, anything said, no congratulations or thanks or anything, just goes on. You know the chances, and that's how it happened. You know the chances of that happening? Of an oversight like that, again, in the Persian kingdom, benefactors, they were hardly ever overlooked. I guarantee you, someone saving the life of the king, this might be the only time in history that ever happened, when just nothing happened. But here it did. You know why? For the same reason that when Joseph interpreted the dream of the cupbearer, he stayed in jail for another 2 years. Why was that? Providence. The cupbearer forgot about him. And God worked. When it comes down to providence, a lot, particularly these biblical stories, God's working on his own timetable. And the timetable matters. If that cupbearer would have told Pharaoh about Joseph 2 years before he did, it would have messed up the whole thing. It was turning to work out exactly the way God wanted it to. And that's exactly what's going on here, what happened here. He saved the king's life, and it was no big deal. Nobody said anything about it. It was just recorded and forgotten about. Until one night, the king couldn't sleep, and he happened to ask for the book of Chronicles to be read to him. And they happened to turn to that spot that took place 5 years ago and read about this, and the king is amazed. You mean we did nothing for this man? And he knows right away he has to rectify that. And so it said at verse 4, and the king said, who is in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows. So all of this happens, and it's read and everything, and nothing, and he finds out nothing has happened, nothing, no good thing has happened to Mordecai. Who's in the court? We have to get someone to help rectify this. And who is it but Haman? What do you call that? Yeah, what do you say? Irony. No, this whole story is full of irony. There's no doubt about that. But that's providence. That's providence. Haman happened to be there at that particular time, right at the right moment. In the other moment, I mean, we can move this thing minutes, and it could have been somebody else in the court. But it all happened at exactly the right time. And so it was Haman that he sees. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And now see, we know this story, but they don't. Nor Haman or the king know the situation. And so the king words this in such a way that would not tip Haman off. Didn't do that on purpose. Like if he would have worded it differently, it would have been the fact that, I mean, Haman would have realized he wasn't talking about him. But the way he words this, he can't tell. I mean, the king's not talking about him. But in his pride, he hears this. Well, who would the king want to honor more than me? And so, you know, his pride, of course, played a part in this. And so now he says to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be said to the man whom the king delights to honor. Think that's a little over the top? Why does he go to that length? Do all of this. Like you read of Joseph's situation when he was exalted in Egypt, some of the same things happened. But Haman goes the extra mile. Joseph, you know, he was given the clothing that was special, all that. But Haman says, no, you ought to bring him the king's robe. You ought to put a crown on his head. Let him ride on the king's horse. Now, by the way, again, I already told you that benefactors, they were given all kinds of things. Like when you stop and think, he's getting way carried away because he's thinking all of this is going to happen to him. But it really wasn't very wise because he could have requested anything. And what was usually given to these kind of people who did something like that would be, you know, land, you know, property and finances and that. All he really is saying the guy should get is some glory from man. Dress him up. And people will praise him and make sure on the king's horse he goes all through the city and everybody would see him. What we're seeing is that's what Haman valued the most. Praise from man. Instead of, hey, okay, he's talking about me. And I'm going to think about me and my family. He had 10 sons. You know, how can I'm in position to help them in their future. King, I want this large property over here, all of this land, you know, that give him that. No, he's hoping he'll be able to put on the royal robe, the crown, sit on the king's horse and be praised for however long, you know, that was. And then that would be it. What we find with Mordecai when this was over, you know what he did? He went back to the king's gate and lived his life. That was it. And that shows that Haman, even if it was for him, he wasn't thinking right because he loved the praise of men. And that's what he wanted. Come to find out, we'll see next week, come to find out it wasn't him at all. It was his greatest enemy. And what a terrible turn of events that was for Haman. And he'll be mortified about that. So we'll look at that next week.